Naturally, since we're at Holden, we have to have a biblical base for this, and so our biblical base is Thessalonians 5:23. Make the God of peace himself sanctify you wholly, and make your spirit and soul and body be kept sound. Present your body as a living sacrifice. And so the concept of that it's one of our responsibilities gives us the law. But the gospel of it all, as I see it, is the freedom that fitness sort of gives to all of us. As I see fitness, it's kind of a means to an end, as opposed to an end in itself. And so I'll be talking about fitness in this sense. I'd like to deal a little bit with play, because I think play is kind of the joy of being fit, in a sense, while at the same time that you can play and therefore get fit. So it has kind of a dual role. Then I see sport. As you noticed, I listed fitness, sport, and play as a little bit different from play. It shouldn't be. I don't think it was designed that way in our country, but because of our competitive society, I think that sport and athletics get to be something sometimes even aside from play. And when I'm talking about sport, I'll be talking in terms of institutionalized or organized or competitive kinds of activities primarily, although I have the term athletics reserved for my real gripe in society. And athletics is what I would call the highly competitive kind of sports. You'll see, however, that athletics is a way of life, so I believe in it. But I believe in it differently than we're living it in our society. Professional sport, for example, is costing us millions of dollars. And it's costing taxpayers some of that money, because the arenas, the community centers, the Houston area, actually tax money supports that. Any of you that support state colleges, and you have no choice if you pay state income tax, you're also paying for athletics. Everybody's telling you you're not, but you are. And in that sense, I think that we ought to start rising up and creating some noise about the way athletics is run. Athletics has become interesting to me because, of course, women are just now sort of moving into it. And the more I get into it, the more shocked I am. That's what's happening even in the high school level in athletics, and it's pretty scary. So I'd like to touch on that in a bit. But I think fitness is my primary concern, in a sense, for the first few minutes. And I could have called this lots of things. I thought about calling it off your seats and on your feet, but I thought that might, or exercise from the cradle to the grave, or the battle of the bulge, or muscle tone for a pureness, muscle tonus for a pureness bonus. But I decided all these were catches, and so I thought fitness for the health of it might be able to catch some of you. The book that I think, if you're a straight fitness addict, and the easiest way towards fitness is aerobics. And many of you have seen Ken Cooper's first book on aerobics. Then finally, Ken Cooper decided there were women in the world, which is unusual for some of our people, and they developed some aerobics for women. However, this book finally does something in a scientific sort of way, in that they've taken an awful lot of people, just normal people like you and me, and worked at, well, how much do they really need to do? What are the things that you can do outside? What are the things that you can do inside? And all aerobics deal with is the cardiovascular system, because that's the entire system that either is going to permit us to move and enjoy it, or not permit us to move. And so what we're really talking about is strength, endurance, flexibility. Primarily, however, the endurance or the cardiovascular system is really the important system that the book talks about. And it is in the bookstore. No profits for me if you get it, but it is kind of an easy road to fitness, and it talks a little bit about the importance of it. And, for example, last week I had probably the largest age range at this gathering, something like from 6 to, I think the man said he was 87. And so I had a large range, but the book almost takes care of it. The book covers the kinds of exercises for children, the kinds of exercises for the 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 50, and then 50 and over. And it's pretty scary if you try to start on a full-fledged fitness program. These two people that said they found out about their fitness going for walks, that's not funny. That is how you find out. And our weekend athletes suffer continuously from this kind of thing. And actually, had you two people, and myself too, walked for 3 miles three times a week, you'd have been ready for this. Which and you can do it in a month. One nice thing about fitness, in a sense, is it really doesn't take a long time to start to feel the value of fitness. In, for example, flexibility is the easiest thing to get. And by the way, you don't need all kinds of flexibility. None of us need to be able to touch our toes to survive. It really has very little to do with our fitness. That's one of the problems we had. We started comparing ourselves with European children. And of course, that's when Eisenhower and everybody got all clutched. It really wasn't so much that we weren't fit, but that others were more fit. It's really the competitive element that got us started in it. And you know, I don't care where the bandwagon came, I like it, so I perpetuate it. But flexibility is probably the most misunderstood. Your kids, some of them, can do splits, and that's just great. But if any of you people try to do a split, you have a good chance of pulling ligaments, tendons, and being unhappy for life. And none of us need to be able to do splits, unless you want to be a gymnast or you want to be chosen a cheerleader. Then you can work up to it in 3 to 6 weeks, but when you stop for anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, it's all gone, brother, and you have to start all over again. And remember that inflexibility. All these programs that tell you, be sure and touch your toes in 3 or 4 days, you don't need it. You need to be able to stoop from your knees, not from stiff knees. You need to be able to bend your back. You don't need to be able to do a back bend. None of you are going to be greater people because you can do a back bend. As a matter of fact, you shouldn't be doing, at least women past 30, really not to do back bends. You know, we already have lumbar lordosis, all of us. You know, this little curve in the back, and the fatter we get, the more we get it. And so we don't, it's something we don't need. You only need flexibility to the normal range of movement in your own joints. And if you happen to have short hamstrings, for example, you just shouldn't really try to touch your toes. You don't want to keep bouncing. On sit-ups, you don't want to go sit-ups beyond the straight line of your body. You begin pulling on your back muscles. And remember, we're elastic. We're like rubber bands. And you pull and you pull. And once you have pulled that rubber band too hard, either it breaks, or you hurt your fingers with it, but it doesn't come back. And so remember that in your flexibility. And flexibility comes the fastest. If you want to be flexible to start skiing, 3 weeks before you start skiing, then you start doing sort of a half knee bend. And you do start rotating around, getting your arms moving, and that sort of thing. Whatever sport you want to do, specific to that sport, you can start doing it. Walking is the best way to get yourself ready for walking up a mountain. Going up stairs, and only going up 3 stairs and back down, will prepare you for Copper Basin, which is a stinker. It's only 3 miles, and everybody thinks it's the place to go. Let me tell you, Kang, it's not the place to go. Take Hart, Holden, take the falls first, then Hart, then Holden. Not the basin, besides the bugs. Then if you make all those, then you trot on up to Lyman. But until then, you just really, it's hard on your hearts, and it's hard on your sorts of beings. Heart, if you take it slow, and if you think about the turtle, by the way, as you walk here, you're going to survive a lot longer. Remember, the turtle always got there, the hare and the turtle, and the rabbit didn't always get there. Now, with your kids, you can let them run because they're going to survive in 2 minutes. They're back in, but we're not. Anybody over 25 is not. And you just need to be ready to, for some of this slow sort of stuff. So easy on the flexibility. But strength is something that you can build within a month. And strength is something that you need for all sports that you will do. That's why there's such a difference between male and female in sport. Because the female hormones secrete, you know what? A lot of it. Fat. And that's a fact. The male hormone secretes muscle tissue. And so here we're running around with fatty tissue, and you guys are running around with muscle tissue. And I don't care what the women libbers say, we're not going to be the same unless we want to take some male hormones and you guys want to run around with some female hormones so you can be flabby too. So we really have a lot more excuse for fat than the men do. But strength, therefore, is more difficult for women. We can have strength for ourselves, but we will never, because of, even at the same weight, if I weigh 140 and a guy weighs 140 and we exercise the same, he's going to have more muscle mass than I am, just by our physiological beings. But we can develop strength, and we need it for all, every sport that we do, because if you want to run, speed comes out of strength. And so strength is important. And developing strength, you can do it several ways, but always you have to do one more than you want to do if you're going to develop strength. And you really do it until you begin to feel it. Now, the longer you've been not doing something, the fewer kinds of things you ought to do in the strength area. But remember, you can build strength by weight, by adding weights. If I add more weight to my finger as I do exercises, I can build strength. I can do it by isometric or isotonic, but that's only just strength in a general sense, not so much for speed or moving in helping it. But I can do that. The other way is, of course, I can do more exercises, and then I can do exercises faster, are the three ways that I can get strength. Do you have a question, or are you taking care of flies?
I read Ken Cooper's original book, and he was going to come through with some kind of statistics comparing the average person to someone that's been following this program, aerobics program, for years. Does he do that?
No, his longevity study isn't done.
It isn't done yet.
No, but what he has done is demonstrated the fitness of women statistically with his group and life expectancy. The problem with all exercise, and if any of you played, particularly if any of you men played any sports, you're in more trouble than the rest of us when you quit. Quitting exercise is one of the difficulties. Like, we have an awful lot of football players that are dead at 40. And what it comes from is that we're learning about enlarged hearts, that athletics in young give us an enlarged heart. And the enlarged heart is good as long as you continue to exercise sort of forever after. But once you get flabby and carry a lot of weight and are out of condition, then those football players are dying off. Now, so are the executives, but particularly the football players are the ones they've done the most study on, and they're beginning to do studies on basketball players who left even playing very vigorously, not competitively through college. They're having some with studies on their death and the enlarged heart. If any of you read about the boys from University of Maryland, two boys died of heart attacks in the last 4 years on the basketball team. But one of the things that happened, and if any of you know really tall men, and now it's happening with tall women, that exercise can be harmful. For women, 6'3", because that's really tall. And the men, the 6'6", 6'7", 6'8" athletes, are finding some heart problems where their heart never grew to the size of their bodies. And that's what's wrong with forcing your 6 to 8 year old kids to play beyond their body. Their heart and lung capacities are half of what they ultimately will be proportioned to their size. And that's why it's pretty scary when we make these kids play so they can't quit. Kids automatically quit when they're tired. Lots of people say they don't, but you watch the Sandlot games, and that 7-year-old kid will quit, even if he's winning, and that means he's, you know, quitting for a different reason. And that's what's scary about some of our organized sports, is that their lung and heart capacities just are not sort of made for that. The third one is endurance. And that's what you will really keep you fit. Because our technological society, our push-button age, has made it so we really don't have to do anything. You know, if you work, how many any of you farmers from the past? Well, those kinds of men survive forever, a lot of them, for two reasons, we think. One, because they are continuously doing exercise, and the second reason is they don't have the stress and strain of the executive sitting. By the way, you women, and myself included, who wanted women's rights, we now are dying of heart attacks just like the men at an earlier age. We were 20 years behind the men until 10 years ago. And now particularly the career-orientated woman is having the same heart attacks at 40. Now we're still about 10 years ahead of the men. Men are going into their lower 30s. And all heart attacks, very few of them started organically. They started with stress and strain and the mental anguish, and that our bodies were made for organic action. And we're putting ourselves in these little territories and not in the big expanse. And so that's one of the reasons we need to preach fitness now where we never had to. When we were a rural society, you know, it really didn't matter. And these kids that lived in the rural society, and we made them take physical education, and then we only gave them exercises, really makes me laugh, because those guys were already so fit. What they needed was play, and learning to play, not learning to have exercise. Yeah, that's right. But us city folks are the ones, you know, we just push a button. I love pushing a button to do my dishes, you know? I love pushing a button to do everything. But then I need to do something else then, and that's what the exercise can do for us. But you know, we don't walk anywhere. And we're really made for walking. And this is what is causing an awful lot of our heart attacks along with anxiety, so that we really are worrying ourselves to death, sitting ourselves to death, and a lot of us eating ourselves to death, and then some of us are doping ourselves to death, and the last thing is we're probably drinking ourselves to death. In our normal average society as we looked at it. All things that are preventable. Heart attacks we're finding, obviously at 55 they're not as preventable, but that had we gone along the whole time and thought about the importance of our cardiovascular system and worked at a form of fitness, that's what this new aerobics does, is it works on a form of fitness that starts with where you are rather than where you want to be. You know, I want to be already at the 12-minute mile or the 18-minute 3-mile or whatever. But that's not where most of us are. And so you need to start where you are. And you don't have to have an exercise program, by the way, for endurance. You can do almost any sport you want to and get it, as long as you stay at the sport and do it approximately 3 times a week, almost no matter what it is. But one of the bigger things that we're not being able to do is to relax, which is another part of fitness, after even with our cardiovascular. We really need to be able to relax. And I'd like to try for just 1 second on this relaxing so that you get kind of a feeling for it and what happens if we don't. We all put your heads down and get as tiny as you can, sort of. Close your eyes and really feel tight. Now raise your head up, just your head. Keep everything way down there and try to look way up. Okay, what do you feel? You like it?
No.
No. Tight here. That's an exaggeration, but that's what happens every time you work in an office, when you sit and study, when you do everything. This is where we start with heart attacks, right up here, between here and here in it. And we're always crunched over. Now crunch way over, again, kind of you're working at the desk. Your head is a little up. Hold your abdomens in as tight as you can. Now try to expand them way out. Notice? That's a pretty tough job. And you know, when we start having round shoulders and working for many hours, that's what we're doing. We're living in the middle thirds of our bodies wrong, all of us. And now that one's easily helped by just kind of sitting and push your stomach way out, like I'm capable of doing all the time, unfortunately. Then pull it in tight. This is kind of an isotonic strength and muscle. Now breathe, but keep your stomachs in. And that's one way of feeling lazy stomachs. And then pull them in and let them out, in and out. And you can do that when you're working any old time for kinds of exercise. The next thing on relaxation is kind of an ability to know when you're tight and know when you're relaxed. Like tighten your muscles now in your arms, your two arms, just as tight as you can. Feel them just tight. Then slowly relax them and make them nothing. Notice how neat that sort of feels. Now with your legs, tighten those. Any place out or wherever it feels, but you really feel them. Toes pointing, terrible, and relax them. You can do this almost anyway. Now, arms and legs tight, abdomen tight, head down, head coming up when it's still tight. Now, start with the head and relax the head. Everything else is tight. Relax the legs, abdomen, arms. Eyes closed now, let your head sort of rest. Now if you don't have high blood pressure or ear problems, let your head roll a little, round in a circle. And come back to rest. Keep your eyes closed. Now legs are not yours, arms are not yours. Now count out loud. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now think nothing. Ah! Now, if you are relaxed, you shouldn't have liked the up. And that's something that your body really needs all the time because of the society we live in. It's a mechanical thing. But that's what we've done with ourselves in society. And so we need some kind of mechanical sort of way in dealing with it. Now, in the area of, what's that word, obesity. That one is very simple in a sense. It's got very simple rules to it. The easiest one, of course, is pushing yourself away from the table. But the next one is to remember, how do you get fat? What's the only way, unless, let's not talk about that 0.5% that have metabolism problems. Most of us don't. 4,400% don't. How do you get fat? Okay, you eat up more calories than you burn. Your input of fuel is greater than your output of fuel, or your input of food is greater than your output of energy. So if you don't want to weigh what you weigh, you got to do two things. One is diet, and that, of course, is a doctor's problem, not ours, if you really are heavy. But for most people, it's really being careful, tossing the desserts primarily, tossing a few, not this week because the bread's the best in town, or any town almost. But even the mashed potatoes are pretty good, and give those up. But you just simply have to have a combination of exercise. And if you do more exercise than you eat, your body will burn it up and you can lose weight. A trip to Holden, if you're out of condition, should help you lose 3 pounds. Now that's not the way to lose it. Even if you eat your way up, and that's one of the things you should do in climbing, by the way, is you eat yourself to the top and you eat yourself back down again in it. Carbohydrates, primarily. And overnight kind of camping is the same sort of way. Eating and water is terribly important on any kind of trip that you're going to take in it. So that's kind of the fitness thing. I'd like to say a few things about play and sport, and then we'll come back to the fitness kinds of questions that you might have. In play, I think play is terribly important and terribly neglected, and that our hospitals were not be as full. Our supply of aspirin, of tranquilizers would not be as necessary if we had a play life. And I think it's terribly important that you begin with your children and for yourself to make it a vital part of your family, to make it a part of your life. And this is all kinds of free play. This is talking about getting dirty out on the lawns. It's talking about camping. It's talking about hiking, walking, biking, all these kinds of things is what I call play. Play might be cutting the lawn, but it probably isn't if you have to cut the lawn. Now, if you're a little sister and you really want to cut the lawn because your big brother got to, then maybe it's play. But if you got to cut the lawn because you got to cut the lawn, then it probably isn't play. And so that play is something that's almost lost in our society. If you look around, our society doesn't play so much as have competitive sports. You look at your kids that are in Little League, which is one of my big fights, is Little League, because you get so little play for so much effort by the kids, and that they really aren't learning to play, nor are they doing something that they're going to be able to do, which in and of itself wouldn't bother me. But when you add to it that you're teaching about 50% failures, and they begin to be failures as 6, 7, and at the very 8-year-olds, then we're really getting a whole generation of kids that aren't going to want to play in the sense of sport and miss out on a lot of things because someplace they think they can't do it. A kid in school who can't read, all the class doesn't necessarily know the kid can't read. But as soon as you put them on the playground and Mr. Boy Jock, physical educator, says we will now do chin-ups, line up the fat and the skinny boys and make them do the same kind of pull-ups or chin-ups, then we're saying to the kid, hey, everybody, look, this kid can't play. And that's one of the big things, I think, in your own PTAs and your own kinds of worlds that you need to watch for your kids, or they're not going to play either in the future. Because it starts at 7. And lots of kids can't throw balls at 7 because of hand-eye coordination. But there isn't one kid, even the handicapped kids, the physically handicapped, the motor morons, can still play. There is some kind of activity in a physical movement sense for everybody. And what we have done with our kids, and it's really scary because I'm a physical educator, is have made them hate sports. We're almost better with little girls. Now it's going to start, of course, the girls have to be competitive. But so far, girls have been free to play. If you watch little girls, they don't just stand and chat, they do play. They have hopscotch, jump rope, they have all kinds of activities. Now, they don't know how to throw a ball, and that's our fault. You know, let all your husbands teach the girls how to throw, because otherwise we're going to have another generation of girl throwers, and then they're not going to be in sports. Because a girl does, by model, throw differently if she doesn't have a good model. Because it's easier in our pectoralis majors to throw wrong than to throw right. And so that girls don't automatically throw well. It's not one of their things. Our stereotypes have kept us from really training little girls. And in some ways, they're better off in the play world. But as they get older, of course, there's no play world left for them. And then the boys have sort of taken over. But if we could combine kind of the girls' play life and the boys' play life, I think that we then could have a good mixture of play. But be sure your kids find something that they like to do, not something that you wish you had done and so they ought to do. Play isn't even like a musical instrument almost. It's not like reading. It's not like anything else. Everybody in the future is going to have opportunity to play because the food supply in 2000 may not be the real issue. It may be that we have so much leisure. And so if our kids can't play, we're making a whole generation of unhappy kinds of people, plus we're more push button and the tube becomes the center as opposed to the play. Already we're finding in an awful lot of the medium low income groups that kids are unfit because they watch the tube. They don't go out to play, and that becomes terribly important, and that you people need to find some kind of play for yourself. And watching a football game is not play. It may be relaxing. It may not be, too, in the studies. But do you realize that in the city of New York, at the last Super Bowl, no, not the Super Bowl, New Year's. What is it? Rose Bowl. The last Rose Bowl game, that in the city of New York, there was a great change suddenly after the first half of the Rose Bowl game in the water level. Now, somebody just happened to look at that 2 years ago. And you know what it was from? right after the half, the water level in the whole city of New York went down. Flushing the Johns, which meant the whole cotton picking city is watching the same thing at the same time. Well, now actually they found that on Roots too. But then they did the Super Bowl, and it's the same sort of thing, which is in some ways a commentary on sport and athletics and on perhaps an area that if you listen to Elmer either today or yesterday talking about how we spend money or use money, that we really need to think twice when we buy 1.5 million a soccer player that was no good in South America. Or Bukowski gave $600,000, the basketball player from that didn't go to Maryland that cost us $20,000 not to get, Moses Malone, something like $1 million guy. Then we begin to look at some of our sport problems. And finally then is the whole world of sport. And I believe in sport. I believe in competitive sport. I believe, by the way, in women in sport and girls in sport, and I think that's up to you people to be sure that they are exposed. But I also call camping, hiking, fishing, hunting a form of sport. Not a form of athletics, but a form of sport. And that's what, as I see fitness, is a means to, so that you then can have life more abundantly, kind of through play and sport, without being in the upper 3%. And if there's anything bad that we've done to the black people in our society, it's to teach them that there are about three things and three sports that they can do for their place in the sun. Originally, what were they?
Baseball.
Not originally. When did the first black... Boxing was number one. But in the 50s, anybody know when, what's this guy's name? Robinson?
Jackie
Robinson moved into baseball? 1947. And so really, the blacks don't think baseball for their, now they do, the Puerto Rican, the Cubans. In 1976, that's kind of their way. But in the 50s and 60s, their way was boxing plus what else?
Basketball.
Bucketball. And we have taken a whole generation of kids in Washington, D.C. and said, the only way up is bucketball. And they have spent their entire lives dedicating themselves to bucketball. Do you know how many we have in the National Basketball League?
Blacks.
67%.
Yeah, and how many participate in pro basketball about?
I don't know, but the figure of the top 40 high school basketball players, only 20 made them. I mean, the college ball.
Right. And then take that down to those who graduate and those who make pro. And so we have something like half of 1% of all the boys that have dedicated their lives to basketball, and particularly black boys at one time, when they could have been doing all these other things, is one of kind of the sins of our society, as I see it in sport. But that two of the really exciting books, I think, that kind of may help us in the change, and maybe women will. Maybe women in sport can make it a sport as opposed to a cheating game. I think one of the things that we have taught in sport is how to cheat. When you look at football, as I understand it, it's almost impossible for the offensive players not to cheat in how they act. In basketball, it's not wrong, whatever you do, as long as you're not caught. And we're teaching kids that. Have you ever watched a little league game in which the kids start screaming about what's happening? A kid knows he's out. He knows that he was tagged. The official doesn't get it, and the kid trots on, and everybody pats him on the back. But in the sandlot, what happens in the sandlot? What happens to the kid who cheats in the sandlot? Yeah. The peers take care of him. Unless he owns the ball, he's sent home. Now, if he owns the ball and bat, he may get to stay. But I think it's a serious commentary on our ethical society in sport that we need to think about it as we're kind of working with kids, is what we're doing to kids in the cheating syndrome. It's an intricate part. Even the 6,000, 10,000 paid athlete, the illegal recruiting that goes on that I'm now finding about in women's sport is a sad commentary if sport is a reflection of our society. one of the neatest books is this one called Winning is Everything and Other American Myths. And it's trying to deal with that you send 128 boys out to in a tennis tournament, and how many of them are going to be considered winners? One, actually one. For example, if I ask even you people, give me all the gold medal winners in the Olympics for America, you might be able to give me half of them. But how many, who won the silver medal in the last Olympics that hadn't won a gold medal sometime or other? And it tells us about our society. What percent of everybody who plays in a basketball game loses? Numerically? What's that word? Anyway, 50%, you know, unless you've got a great pro. So that what we really haven't taught is that sport is play. And we're doing everything by a failure syndrome. Worse almost than the Fs that we give in our classrooms. And this kind of deals with it. For young children, there's another book that's called Every Kid a Winner, which talks about how kids can win in sport. And it talks about ice hockey in the universe around Edmonton in Alberta, where they have every kid playing every 2 minutes and they don't keep score. They're playing round robins without a score. And the first year, competition went down. And the second year, they were joining because they were learning to play. They were having fun. And every 2 minutes, the teams change. And so he's a red half the game, he's a blue the other half, he's a yellow some other part of it, and they're really playing. And that's kind of what was happening. The other one, which is for all of you people, is called The Ultimate Athlete. And it talks about no matter what, how you were ruined as a kid in terms of sport and life and on a fitness kind of thing, that you can be an ultimate athlete for yourself as long as you reach your own greater potential in sport. And it's kind of a really interesting book. So I'd like to open it up now for questions, comments, anything on the fitness, the sport.
Is it possible to maintain your weight like me at age 25 to maintain my same weight like when I'm 60 years? I suppose
only
you'll get older and you
No. It's possible, but it's far more work. The kind of magic age is 35 or 40 for women. Men should be able to maintain their weight after 45. Actually, before the onset of menopause, it becomes very difficult in the woman's chemistry, that automatically the hormonic secretions add to body tissue or fat for women. So what you really have to do past 40, unless you're terribly active, is to cut down your input of food. So it's not any more necessary than your own discipline. And so it really ends up your discipline. But there's no question women must work much, much harder at it by virtue of their chemistry than the male. But the woman can afford to be fatter without a heart attack than the man can, according to our studies. As soon as the man puts 20 pounds more on him than he needs, he's a better heart attack guy. Just as he gets higher rank, he's a better heart attack potential. And that's the number one killer for men, by the way, is some form of stress, strain, and therefore heart attacks.
I was just going to mention or comment a little bit. You mentioned the play is getting to be a lost art, and I notice in the neighborhood where I'm living, every mother is so uptight about getting her kids in the proper lessons. You know, the kids in the summer are... You know, mothers complain about they're driving their kids all over, and it's a big chore for them. And the kids really don't want to go to all these lessons anyway. They really just play. But everybody's got to get in on gymnastics early or swimming early and all of these different things. And our kids get somewhat caught up in this, too, I've got to admit. But when they go to my hometown in Minnesota in the summer, the kids in the neighborhood just play ball, and they absolutely love it. They just, that's their biggest thing, too, because they just play without any organized thing. And that's the way I grew up, and I keep thinking, you know, why don't kids do it? And our kids in the neighborhood don't do that. They don't get together and play games.
We don't do it because parents don't encourage it, for one thing. Parents, I think, in the past just let kids play because it was acceptable. But now the richer you are, the more affluent are members of our society, the less they let kids just play. This is one of the most exciting places in the world. Kid will fall down, somebody else picks them up. And they play at everything. When you ask them what they've done, they really don't know what they've done, but they've had a great day. Yeah. I saw the neatest little boy about 4 years old sitting in dirt, absolutely having a ball. And I thought, you know, in the city, mother would be dying and have them clean three times.
Clean in flower beds.
It's really an incredible way of life. Another problem we're bumping into is the baby, not the baby cribs, what do you call those?
Playpens.
That kids really don't get any movement in playpens because they don't have, they can't explore. That you aren't giving them any freedom for exploration if you're, you spend their, if they spend their lives in a playpen. Which is kind of scary. Yeah.
Do you think it's based on economics, mm-hmm. or is it based on society that we're becoming more mobile? The parents want to become and do more things themselves, and the only way they can do it is have somebody else babysit for them, more or less, send them to the Y for lessons, or, you know, send them to the piano lesson for a half hour or something like that, so I can go and do what I want to do, you know, instead of letting them be in the backyard playing.
Well, I don't think so, because the parents have to do all the driving and the taking. Now, some of them, maybe, I worked at a private camp in Maine for 6 summers that the kids were sent there for all summer because the parents wanted to go to Europe and they wanted to play. And they were a heck of a lot better off with us than at home. But yeah, maybe, you know, maybe some of them
because
are.
Because your society is becoming more mobile than, you know, well, with my folks or, you know,
yeah.
our generation, they weren't as much moving and going to as much society events. Which might, I don't know, might.
Well, it's certainly economic, because it's the people that have the money that are kind of caging their kids more than any other.
I think it tends to be competition. Parents like to talk about, my child did this, and he's really good, and he won this tennis tournament, and, you know, if you don't have a child that's doing any winning, you really feel proud of it. Or else maybe it's that they didn't have a chance to take these lessons. That might be the other thing.
Yeah, some of it is what their folks didn't get to do. But I think the worst thing in the world for our kids is when they come home. In tennis, for example, when the mothers are there. Tennis I know the most about. And there's nothing worse than a tennis mother. Now, a basketball father is bad, but a tennis mother is the worst. I mean, you know, she practically shines either girl or boy shoes and is right there and makes sure they have their Gatorade and all these. These are 10-year-olds. And not, you know, how did you play? Did you try the new shot? Did you win? No? Did you win today? It's no wonder. And probably all of us do that. I caught myself with my nephew. He came home from a basketball game, quite happy, so I was sure he won. So I said, did you win? He said, oh, no, I lost, but I made 2 buckets. And I've never seen the bucket before. And I realized that I was doing the same thing, caught up in my own kind of winning syndrome as opposed to improvement. I definitely think in baseball, and now in women's sports, I've had about 10 fathers. I work on the national level in Athletic Association, which is the counterpart of NC2A, and I've had about 10 fathers calling me about the scholarships for their daughter. Well, now my daughter is absolutely the very best in basketball. I'm sending you her clippings, and she got a scholarship for $500, but she wants the $1,000 one. Can I get out of this contract for that contract? They're selling them just like meat off the hoof of the men. Incredible.
I'm from Iowa, and I don't know, in Iowa we have had girls basketball, and I've only been in Iowa for 5 years, which has been, the girls basketball was new to me. But there, you get a lot of people, the girls basketball in a lot of small towns is better than the guys, and you get a lot of the parents will talk to their coaches. I've associated with one of the coaches that was coaching the boys, and had a bad team, and he parents went up and said, wouldn't you like to have my girl playing on your team? And I don't think parents realize that there's a difference between a women's sport and men's sports.
Yeah, well, women libbers don't understand it either in terms of, originally this whole Title IX problem is that they want to integrate the team, and as soon as you integrate the team, you can forget about women having a role. Well, 0.5% of the girls, and not even in basketball, because we've got 3 inches already. On the average, 3 inches shorter. And the whole touch sort of thing, there's a few, rifle is the only sport I know, because, no, archery takes strength, and when you get to that 60 yard, you start to have some problems. Now, you can play side by side, or you can play mixed, in terms of 3 and 3 or whatever. But as soon as you try to pit one against the other, the girl ultimately loses. If you have a sport in which there's one team, the girl's already lost in terms of it. Iowa, by the way, just is passing that they have to get rid of the 6-person game.
Are they passing it?
Yeah, they went to court. Tennessee went to court first. And you know why? Not because it's not a good game, because the girl will not be able to get as many scholarships. Mm-hmm. Just about.
No, so Iowa, and I don't.
Well, that's in court right now.
Okay. Yeah,
Tennessee was just changed from 6-person to 5-person. And I want you to know, the women played basketball in 1895 exactly like the men. And in 1896 they started changing it until we had this conglomeration. Yeah.
I was going to ask you whether you were familiar with the YMCA's Youth Basketball Association. It was brought to the forefront back in New England this past winter. And it's a program whereby the Y tries to get any kid who wants to play basketball and get parents and any adult of any sort involved in the program. And the emphasis is not on winning. It's on teaching values. And in our small community, our elementary school, this is an elementary school program. And in our elementary school, which is maybe 350 students, we had about 60 kids last winter that were involved in this. And I don't know how many parents and other adults. And he said it was just the greatest thing going. Everybody got a chance to play all the time. And they'd play a while, and they'd stop, and they'd talk values. And it was the educational idea of doing things together. They all had a chance to learn the sport. And there was no emphasis on winning. They played some games, and it was, if they won, that was great. If they didn't, it was fine. Everybody had a good time. And they said it was
can perpetuate.
They got some national basketball players involved in it, and in the larger communities, they get them in, and they talk to the kids and inspire them and this sort of thing. But the emphasis, we thought, was really great. And the Y is really pushing this. Mm.
I'll never forget the time when I was at Texas A&M and they asked for volunteers to coach basketball. And I said, well, I would be more than happy to do it. Found out that they were 6 and 7 years old. They couldn't even hardly hold the basketball up, much less find the hoop where it was, you know. And it was only 7 feet or 8 feet high. But we went through the whole season. We never won a game. But we had the greatest time. But what was really interesting at the end, we had 4 teams. And our team, I think as a unit, probably had more fun. But they all passed out ribbons. And there was a blue for first and a red for a second and white for third. And we got the 4th place ribbon, and it was pink. But all the kids ran back to the moms and said, Mommy, Mommy, look to see what I won. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think sports are great, but the difficulty gets to be when the winning syndrome, and that's what we live by. You know, everybody knows Lombardi's winning isn't everything; it's the only thing, and win at all costs. That, and how you go about it. We're having a couple seminars next year, trying to figure out how can we as physical educators deal with values that we certainly, the values that we have taught, haven't been character building unless character building is, you know, push and shove and get to the top.
In our little town in South Dakota, that winning syndrome was so deadly. Those little guys that go out in basketball, like 5th, 6th, 7th grade, that first string senior high team is being picked then. And that first string starts to play all the time in those games, and then that same first string plays in junior high basketball. And you know, that's 5 boys that are playing basketball. The others are bench sitting and getting in there. And the same with football. The others are scrimmaging, and then that first string plays, and they start them way back. It's the most vicious thing in the whole time, that winning.
It's really tough to break, too, because particularly if you've got the fathers so engrossed in it. And the problem is all the rest of these kids could have been learning. I'm not against those 5 kids learning ball, but I'm against the next 35 not learning any other sport and not enjoying the basketball on their level.
What do you do in college for as a physical education when you pass out grades?
Well, I only teach majors, but what we do on the service program is based on knowledge of the sport by virtue of the skills strategy of the game, and a skill as part of it, playing understanding and strategies of it, the same as any other academic sort of course, and improvement from where you were to where you went.
Well, give me your comments on the difference of the physiology between men and women, and then the Title IX co-ed physical education that's, I think, coming in across the country,
right,
in Colorado. What are the problems you see with co-ed physical education, and what are the good things that possibly are?
Well, that's a good question. That's one of the areas I've been working in a lot. I see a huge difference between competitive athletics, meaning interscholastic play, and the common run. Because according to all of the physiology things, still run the course, just as, you know, from male to femaleness runs the course. On the lower end, you have the women. The 50% in the middle are going to have overlap, and in the top, you have the men. And if you will homogeneously group these kids, I'm all for co-ed. And as a matter of fact, I testified for co-education as a part, because I think that, except in contact sports, and they're still having, contact sports may be separate. And contact sports now is being defined as basketball, wrestling, boxing, football. Soccer is up in the air right now. Field hockey is up in the air on what it is. But what it says is anytime you pick a team by skill, you can have separate. So therefore, in the teaching, I think they're going to learn together and play together, and that therefore, of course, it's going to help the women the most, in a sense, because they're going to become skillful. But what it can also do is permit the guys not to have to be great to be human. So that, in other words, if the girls are great, then it's no longer male-femaleness of boys are physically great in sport and girls aren't. As the girls get better and better, I think it's going to free the men to either be good in sport or not to be good in sport, because they're playing together. And they learn such things as I'm a setter and I'm a spiker by virtue of their size, not by virtue almost of their sex. The problem, as I see it, are the teachers. Our teachers are not prepared, at least the women teachers, are not prepared to teach the guys, and the guys are definitely not prepared to teach the women. I hate teaching women, and it's the fault of our culture. In fact, I haven't taught beginners on the college level where I had a choice in a long time, because I have no patience for it. I really like teaching guys because they can learn it, and they can't learn it because there's so much more skilled. They can learn it because they've been exposed to throwing a ball. Now, if I can't throw a softball 60 feet, I can't serve a tennis ball hard. They're exactly the same movements. And if I learn to throw that way, then I have to relearn. But a guy who learned to throw a ball can learn tennis. But if we start these kids, it's going to be tough on the high school girls for a little while.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The junior high school that I'm at, there is... we gave the Presidential Fitness Awards at the end of the year, and there were 37 girls that won the award in the school, and three boys. And the men teachers say that's because we've been holding back our program all year, you know, because the girls have, you know, really increased. I think the girls got an advantage this year. But they're saying that the boys didn't achieve their fitness potential because, you know, the girls were in the class. And the girls had to work up a little bit higher because the boys were in the class. So you have...
Now, I think you're going to have those problems as you transfer anything. But I don't think ultimately that is going to be true. As the girls learn to play, the same as if they really teach, then we're going to have an awful lot of guys that can play, because guys right now don't learn because of the coach syndrome, where they're teaching just because they're coaching in it. And I think some guys may be held back, but then what you have to do is change your school system to divide by skill level. And you'll maybe only have five girls in the advanced and maybe only five guys in the beginning. But they'll all learn better, because we know in sports that you learn best by teaching and then by some mingling. But it's a lot of work. Title IX brings a whole new emphasis, and maybe parents are going to wake up to how bad we've been, that our coaches haven't been teachers. They've been coaches, period. And the worst thing that they can do for women is all the men failures are moving into women's athletics. And you better stop them. You know, I don't mind having a good guy teach women, but I don't want some guy that's failed in men's sports to hop over and teach girls' sports. And that's one of the other things that's kind of happening.